KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I have a lot of respect for C.P. Brown. I got to know him over the course of a month. He's an honorable man, not the right man for the moment.
A leadership shakeup at the Pentagon after President Trump fires the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
It's Monday, February 24th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. This hour, an art museum exhibit in Greenland's capital imagines what it would be like if the territory had its own military.
So people have been coming in and have been reacting with, like, awe and with, like, I think bafflement as well.
Also, German voters have elected a new chancellor. Friedrich Merz will try to form a coalition government.
The Grand Coalition will probably move toward the right to address voter concerns such as migration and a slowing German economy.
And we remember Roberta Flack after these headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. French President Emmanuel Macron was at the White House today looking to show there is still solidarity between President Trump and European allies when it comes to Ukraine. NPR's Mara Liasson reports the meeting comes on the third anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
While Macron spoke about the need for any peace agreement between Russia and Ukraine to have security guarantees, which would include European peacekeeping troops and an American backup, Trump didn't talk about any role for the U.S. to guarantee the peace. He did say he would end the war soon.
I've spoken to President Putin, and my people are dealing with him constantly, and his people in particular. And they want to do something. I mean, that's what I do. I do deals.
Earlier in the day, the U.S. made a stunning break with its allies at the United Nations, voting with North Korea, Iran, and Russia against a resolution that marked the third anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Mara Liasson, NPR News.
With a deadline fast approaching for federal workers to submit their weekly list of accomplishments or risk being fired, the Office of Personnel Management sent a message to the federal workforce today saying the reporting is voluntary. Health and Human Services workers were told in an email if they did choose to respond, they should, quote, assume that what you write will be read by malign foreign actors and tailor your response accordingly. Other agents and agencies, including the State Department, National Intelligence, and the FBI, also told employees not to respond to the email sent over the weekend by Elon Musk and endorsed by President Trump. The Trump administration has placed thousands of USAID workers on paid administrative leave. Some are speaking out about the impact of the disruption. Chris Wemington, member station WAMU, has more.
Liz is a 16-year USAID employee who spent much of her career working on youth issues across the developing world. We are using her first name only to protect her from retaliation. She says the effective closure of the agency will have dramatic impacts on global health, like the spread of HIV.
If our clinics were open, we could have prevented the transmission from mother to newborn, but we haven't been able to do that. That is a gut punch because it's so easy and it doesn't cost us a lot of money to save other people's lives.
Among the thousands of employees placed on administrative leave, 1,600 positions will be eliminated, according to a memo published on the agency's website. For NPR News, I'm Chris Remington in Washington.
A judge hearing the case of the Associated Press versus members of President Trump's staff who barred the news agency from presidential events is declining to immediately reinstate full White House access. The AP sued in federal court. Dispute centers on the agency's refusal to conform to Trump's renaming the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. The AP cites the fact its audience is global and the waters involved are not only in U.S. territory. Stocks continue to drift for much of today. The Dow was up 33 points. You're listening to NPR. He's had a varied career that's included writing best-selling books, serving as a conservative pundit on TV shows, and a popular podcast. He also ran unsuccessfully for office. Now it looks like Dan Bongino will have a new job, serving as the FBI deputy director. President Trump announcing the appointment of Bongino over the weekend and praising him, saying it's, quote, great news for the nation's law enforcement and judicial system. Bongino joins Kash Patel at the Bureau, another staunch Trump loyalist. New tariffs on aluminum and steel set to take effect next month may cause your grocery bill to go up. As NPR's Joe Hernandez explains, the two materials are used in the packaging of a variety of everyday products.
Soups, soda, beer, and more come in aluminum and steel cans, which could become costlier to make under the new tariffs. President Trump announced earlier this month that he would impose the 25% tax on imported aluminum and steel beginning in March. American can makers rely on materials sourced from abroad. According to the Can Manufacturers Institute, 10% of aluminum and 70% of steel used to make cans in the U.S. come from foreign sources. Food and beverage industry experts say the increased costs of making aluminum and steel cans will likely end up being passed on to consumers. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
Veteran NBC anchor Lester Holt, who's been with the network since 2000, has announced he is stepping down from the flagship nightly news broadcast. Holt, who's been in the anchor chair for 10 years, plans to remain at the network and sent a note to staff. He intends to expand his duties with Dateline. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Senator Jack Reed, Democrat from Rhode Island, has a question for retired Air Force Lieutenant General Dan Kane. Quote, will he have the ability to speak truth to power? Senator Reed is the top Democrat on the Armed Services Committee, and he will get the chance to pose that question directly to General Kane during his confirmation hearings for the position of chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Kane is President Trump's pick to replace General C.Q. Brown, who was fired on Friday, along with several other top Pentagon officials. We're going to talk about the shakeup now with Frank Kendall. Until about a month ago, he was a top Pentagon official as Secretary of the Air Force. Secretary, welcome to All Things Considered.
Hello, Mary Louise. It's good to be with you.
Hey, so to be clear, your departure was part of the regular turnover when a new administration takes over, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, as you well know, this is the highest ranking officer in the U.S. Armed Forces. They are appointed to serve four-year terms. They also serve at the pleasure of the president. So just it is within a president's powers to pick a new head of the Joint Chiefs, correct?
It is. I've never seen it done before quite this way. Normally, chiefs carry over from one administration to another very smoothly without any interruption. And as far as I know, there was no reason not to do that in this case.
You have concerns about General Brown being fired. Just lay out for us what they are.
Sure. First of all, General Brown's one of the, if not the finest officer I've ever worked with. One of the things that stands out about the military services in the United States is the apolitical nature of all of our officer corps. And I've been through a lot of transitions, and I have seen in every case very smooth professional transitions where people, you know, they adapt to the policies of the new team in charge, they follow orders as they should, and they give good advice.
I want to play a little bit of what this is Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, who went on Fox yesterday and spoke about C.Q. Brown. Here's what he said.
I have a lot of respect for C.Q. Brown. I got to know him over the course of a month. He's an honorable man, not the right man for the moment.
Hegseth has in past shared his view that the Pentagon needs to be purged of, and I quote, the woke stuff. And he said that doing so would start with firing C.Q. Brown, who I will note is black. How do you think, Secretary, that this may fit into the stated overt efforts by the Trump administration to scale back DEI?
I don't really understand the connection, quite frankly. I also don't understand the obsessiveness about wokeness, whatever that is. You know, it's perfectly within the purview of a new secretary and president to change policies, and that's perfectly fine. And I think all the officers who serve and would take carry out those orders. To be a lawful order, it'd be no problem. There isn't much there to actually remove. There's a few hours of training a year. And again, I don't know what they mean by wokeness. I'm not sure what they mean by that at all. The impact of what they've done is to politicize these positions to a degree that I've never seen before. These officers serve apolitically. They are loyal to whoever's in power. They carry out their policies. And what's been created by doing this is an environment in which career officers suddenly have to worry about their political alignment.
And just to stay with the questions about wokeness, I hear you saying you don't even understand what that means. I think the Trump administration would argue that means diversity initiatives have been pursued at the expense of performance. In your long experience at the Pentagon, did you see that?
No, absolutely not. We did pay attention to disparities in the Department of the Air Force. We had some studies that were done under the previous Trump administration that showed significant disparities, but we never lowered any of our standards about moving people into positions or promoting them or anything else that was competitively selected.
Do you know General Kane, President Trump's pick for chairman? Is he qualified?
I do. I have no reason to say that he's not qualified, except for the fact that he does not have the experience that is normally associated with that job. Normally, and by law, a person who goes into the chairman's job, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, should have served as a four-star general in another major command, mm-hmm. either as a head of one of the military services or as a head of one of the major component commands around the world. General Kane has not done that.
I also want to ask about the removal of some of the Defense Department's top military lawyers in this purge.
Yes.
This is not generating headlines as big as removing the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Why is it worth paying attention to?
I find that more troubling in a way than removing the other individuals that have been removed.
Why?
He seems to want to have JAG officers who will say yes to whatever operational people want to do. Judge Advocate Generals, which are the lawyers in uniform, basically. They're the people who administer the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the criminal law that applies to people serving, and also interpret things like the laws of armed conflict or the laws that would restrict the use of the military against American civilians. So they have a very important role to play. They're professionals. They're not political appointees at all. So to just reach down within the structure and remove the legal authorities that would constrain the behavior of the military, ensure that the military follows lawful orders, is very troubling to me.
Retired Air Force Secretary Frank Kendall, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you, Mary Louise. Good to be with you.
There is a debate playing out in Greenland, sparked by President Trump's ambition to take the island. It's about power, sovereignty, and control. Those are also issues explored in an exhibit at a museum in Nuuk, Greenland's capital. Our co-host Juana Summers takes us there.
The first thing I hear is the sound of a siren, the sound echoing through the room. There's a TV screen with a recruitment video in front of me. I read the subtitles aloud.
And now, as we sleep, the world is closing in. There is no use in hiding. But don't despair. There is a solution. Defend your country against the world invasion. Join the Greenlandic forces.
The walls of this museum are covered with posters. There are olive green fatigues and military jackets with the logo of the Greenlandic Army. Greenland, though, doesn't have its own army. All of this is art, a collaboration between a Danish artist, Asmund Hafstein Mikkelsen, and a Greenlandic artist, Inuk Silishoge.
So we're on the second floor of the exhibit now, and we're walking into this green, fairly modest tent where there's a video that showed what would have happened if we were enlisting in this fictional Greenlandic military. Let's listen.
This exhibit is called Melting Barricades. We're seeing it today inside a big white-walled room in the Nuuk Art Museum. But these pieces are derived from this massive performance piece that was staged in the heart of the city.
Suddenly there was a whole military action in the center of Nuuk, and everybody was like, why are these people here?
This is Nivi Christensen, the museum's director. She said some people believed it was real.
The politicians actually called the Danish government to be like, why do you have a military action in the center of Nuuk? Why haven't you announced that there is a huge military. And they were like, we don't know. There wasn't supposed to be a military action.
This performance piece made the front page of newspapers in Greenland, reprints of some of those newspapers around the walls, along with images of the artists in military attire. They're driving around in a tank with the red and white Greenlandic flag billowing behind them. It would be easy to think that this is all the artist's response to President Trump's recent rhetoric, but this exhibit is actually more than two decades old. It was created in 2004.
So people have been coming in and have been reacting with like awe and with like, I think, bafflement as well. I think people have been like, what just happened? How could they sort of reflect on these issues back in 2004 and making it so relevant now, 20 years later?
The Nuuk Art Museum acquired the work last year.
And then, of course, the world happened and Trump happened and all of this militarization of Greenland just happened and everything just became even more relevant in the context of this show than it was before.
There's also a map that imagines what it would be like if Denmark was part of the United States of Greenland. The artists have renamed parts of the country. It resembles Trump's decision to rename the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America. We stop near a stretch of wall. I see some schematics hanging. One of them shows what looks like a kayak, but when you look closer, it's been rigged with weapons. The tip is full of grenades. Put simply, it's a suicide machine.
This is a suicide kayak. This kayak doesn't have a motor, so you can't just jump out of it and it wouldn't go anywhere, right? So you have to be in it. Of course, we didn't have a Department of Defense. We still don't have a Department of Defense. We don't have our own military. So this whole show became this like investigation of what does it mean to have a military and what does it mean to if you don't have it and like what happens and what kind of values do we put into our society through military actions.
Greenlanders are raising real questions about their future and whether Denmark has done enough to keep them safe. Denmark controls Greenland's foreign policy and defense. The country recently announced a major increase in military spending for the Arctic. This exhibit was supposed to close to the public at the end of 2024.
But we decided to keep it there because of the whole world situation, so it felt wrong to take it down.
Nivi Christensen isn't sure when this exhibit will come down now. When it does, some pieces will become part of the Nuuk Art Museum's permanent collection. And maybe, eventually, it could have an American audience. Christensen jokingly refers to that possibility as a second invasion.
Any chance that this exhibit will be invading the U.S.?
I think that could be fun, to invade the U.S. with this collection.
Tomorrow on All Things Considered, we meet a local guide in one of Greenland's biggest tourist destinations and set out on a boat to the icebergs.
This is one of the biggest tourist attractions in this part of the country. Look at all that ice. There's so much ice that's broken off that is just floating free in the water as we go past the icebergs. Moving pretty quickly now.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. A year ago, President Trump was fighting 13 felony counts in Georgia for trying to overturn the 2020 election. And the district attorney who charged him was seen as a rising star. Now, Trump is president again, immune from prosecution for the next 4 years. And Fulton County Prosecutor Fonnie Willis has been rebuked by the courts and is fighting to keep the case alive. WABE's Sam Greenglass reports from Atlanta.
Donald Trump and Fonnie Willis began their second terms in office just a few weeks apart.
I, Fonnie Taifa Willis, do swear and affirm.
To celebrate, the district attorney hosted an inaugural gala. The dress code, black, pink, and gold.
Lift every voice and sing.
4 years ago, Willis was elected the county's first female DA. She became known for high-profile racketeering cases, indicting defendants like Trump and rapper Young Thug. But both of those cases became mired in drama. At the gala, Willis expressed no regrets.
In my first 4 years in office, I learned a really hard lesson. Folks are here for you during the good times, but the slightest bit of wind and folks quickly begin to fall to the wayside.
Last January, a Trump co-defendant lodged a serious allegation that the DA was involved in a romantic relationship with Nathan Wade, the special prosecutor she hired for the case. He ultimately resigned, but in December, the Georgia Court of Appeals ruled that Willis and her office should still be removed from the case. Trump praised the decision. On stage and with Nathan Wade seated at her table, Willis excoriated it.
See, there are judges in my very state, in my very courthouse, that are more interested in their next appointment than upholding the rule of law and following their oath.
Willis did not shy away from slamming Trump, just not by name, and closed asking the audience what they were willing to sacrifice in pursuit of justice. Georgia State University law professor Anthony Michael Kreis.
There's a lot of room for redemption here, but this case is much more on life support than it's ever been before.
Kreis says Trump had almost no chance of going to trial last year, no matter what Willis did, once the U.S. Supreme Court established broad presidential immunity. Trump's 14 remaining co-defendants could still see trial in the next few years, but if Willis is disqualified for good by the Georgia Supreme Court, Kreis says it's unlikely anyone will be appointed to take over.
If Fonnie Willis is removed and none of the co-defendants are ever brought to trial, I think this will be a real mark of shame.
Many Republicans have praised the prosecution's unraveling as a triumph for justice. And Georgia GOP lawmakers are continuing their own investigation into Willis. But at a farmer's market in a liberal Atlanta neighborhood, Wendy Cooper says she feels empathy for the DA.
As a black woman living in America, this is to be expected. That powerful, smart African-American women are really the target of a lot of hatred.
Cooper says even if Willis had pulled off a conviction, it probably wouldn't have mattered. Trump had already been found guilty on charges in New York.
But did that have an impact on the election? No.
Atlanta residents Lorraine and Andy Rainey strongly disagree with the court removing Willis, but they also feel like she bungled the best shot to hold Trump responsible for his actions after 2020.
Because she knew better. I was hopeful, and then it slowly faded.
Last fall, Lorraine begrudgingly voted to keep Willis in office, but Andy?
No, I didn't vote for her this past November.
What'd you do, leave it blank? Or?
I did.
Andy Ramey says he's fed up with the justice system, fed up with how Willis handled such an important case, and most of all, fed up with the country that sent Trump back to the White House. For NPR News, I'm Sam Greenglass in Atlanta.
83% of German voters cast a ballot in yesterday's election, the most since reunification. And they voted for a change in government. The country will have a new chancellor, lawyer and businessman Friedrich Merz. His conservative party will likely govern with only one other coalition partner. That's a formula that could make Germany's government more decisive and efficient. NPR Berlin correspondent Rob Schmitz reports.
Jetzt darf auch mal Rambo Zambo im Adenauer.
At a late-night victory party in Berlin, Germany's next chancellor, Friedrich Merz, told supporters to celebrate now because starting the next day, they'll need to get to work. Merz says he wants to form a coalition government by mid-April, which for Germany is lightning fast.
Die Welt da draußen wartet nicht auf uns.
The world out there, said Merz, won't wait for Germany. It does not have time for lengthy coalition negotiations. We need to start governing so that we can do the right thing, both at home and in Europe.
Das auf der Welt wahrgenommen wird, Deutschland wird wieder zuverlässig.
For the past 4 years, the three-party coalition government of Olaf Scholz moved slowly, often squabbling among itself over how to support Ukraine without angering Russia, or how to stimulate the economy without taking on debt. That argument ended up collapsing Scholz's government and led to yesterday's early election. And this election exposed a trend that mainstream politicians are trying to smother: the rise in popularity of the nationalist far-right Alternative for Germany party, known by its German acronym, the AfD. The party is under state surveillance for the threat it poses to Germany's democracy, and its members routinely trivialize the Holocaust. One out of every 5 Germans voted for the AfD.
Dass unsere Hand ausgestreckt ist, um den Willen des Volkes.
At the party's headquarters in Berlin, AfD co-chair Alice Weidel said her party's hand was outstretched, ready to govern with Merz's party to honor what she called the will of the people. Later in the evening, though, on a German television program where all of the party's chancellor candidates were in the same room, Merz announced he would not govern with the AfD. And Weidel's tone suddenly changed. Merz, said Weidel, won't be able to form a stable coalition without us. He will face the consequences, she said, when he crashes and fails. And then Merz shot back. The so-called Alternative for Germany is not interested in real solutions, said Merz. The party thrives on problems and it has no interest in solving them. On the contrary, he continued, the AfD is happy to see problems get worse. Merz also criticized what he called Elon Musk's meddling in the German election by supporting the AfD.
Für mich wird absolute Priorität haben, so schnell.
My number one priority, said Merz, is to strengthen Europe as quickly as possible so we can become independent from the United States. I never thought I'd say this, said Merz, but after Donald Trump's statements last week, it's clear the Americans don't care about the fate of Europe. Becoming independent from the United States will not be easy. It's going to require a costly overhaul of Germany's beleaguered military. And that will require Merz's government to relax Germany's debt brake, a rule enshrined in Germany's constitution that prevents the government from running a budget deficit. The other problem is the AfD. Merz's party will have to form what's called a grand coalition with the other centrist party in parliament, the Social Democrats, and the AfD will be waiting in the wings for them to make mistakes, says U.S.-German Marshall Fund's Suda David Vilp.
So the grand coalition will probably move toward the right to address voter concerns such as migration and also a slowing German economy.
And to address that, she says, Merz will need more money than his budget may allow to bring the country's lackluster infrastructure, defense, and industry back up to speed. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
This is NPR News.
In a new memoir, Sonny Vaccaro details his legendary career in sports marketing, starting with the signing of Michael Jordan to Nike.
What I was able to do for the first and last time to say to the public, ladies and gentlemen, this is how it happened.
Legends and Souls, the memoir of an American original. Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Coming up, we remember music legend Roberta Flack.
As my voice teacher said to me years ago, Roberta, find your light. Where's your light? Pretend you're underneath it. Find the light.
She started off as a school teacher and went on to become a Grammy Award-winning superstar.
First, the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. President Trump has named right-wing podcaster Dan Bongino as the deputy director of the FBI. Trump announced the controversial pick this afternoon on his social media platform, as NPR's Ryan Lucas reports.
Dan Bongino is a former New York police officer and ex-Secret Service agent. After leaving law enforcement, he unsuccessfully ran for public office and became a right-wing pundit and host of a popular podcast. In his media appearances, he has repeatedly denigrated liberals and was banned from YouTube for pushing COVID-19 disinformation. Now, Trump has tapped him for the number two job at the FBI as deputy to Kash Patel, putting two Trump loyalists in charge of the nation's most powerful law enforcement agency. The move adds to concerns that the FBI and its vast powers could be used to go after Trump's perceived political enemies. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Israel is calling for the UN Security Council to condemn what it calls the heinous murders of two young Israelis and their mother by Hamas. NPR's Michelle Kellerman tells us the bodies were returned to Israel as part of a ceasefire and hostage deal.
As the family laid to rest Shiri Bibas and her two sons, Israel's ambassador to the UN was expressing outrage. Danny Denon says an Israeli forensic analysis shows that they were murdered and did not die in an Israeli airstrike, as Hamas claims.
These monsters looked into the eyes of a nine-month-old baby and his four-year-old brother and strangled, beat, twisted, and shattered them with their hands.
The family has been a symbol of Israeli anguish over the October 7th attacks. Denon says the UN has not done enough to condemn Hamas. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
This is NPR. Grammy Award winner Roberta Flack has died at the age of 88 after being diagnosed with ALS several years ago. The singer and pianist was known for her intimate vocal and musical style on Killing Me Softly with his song, and in the early 1970s for this hit that was used in the Clint Eastwood film Play Misty for Me.
The first time ever I saw
her publicist says Flack died at home in New York today, surrounded by family. For the second year in a row, Miami Beach will institute month-long restrictions to tamp down spring break crowds. Julia Cooper of member station WLRN has the story.
Throughout the month of March, Miami Beach will institute $100 parking fees, sobriety checkpoints, curfews, and limited sidewalk seating, among other restrictions. The crackdown follows a spate of shootings in recent years, including two that were fatal in 2023.
We saw that the measures we took last year were necessary, and it worked. We had an incredibly successful spring break. No fatalities, no shootings, no stampedes.
That's Miami Beach Mayor Stephen Miner. He says that while the long-term goal is to eventually be able to loosen restrictions, there aren't plans for when that might happen. The restrictions go into effect February 27th.
And you're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. Earlier this month, a line item in a State Department spreadsheet caused some controversy. It appeared as if the Trump administration was planning to spend $400 million on vehicles from Tesla, a company that's owned by top White House official Elon Musk. The State Department has since backed away from these plans. It says the talks with Tesla began in the previous administration. But NPR's Bobby Allen obtained a document that undercuts the Trump administration's story, and he's here now. Hi, Bobby.
Hey, Ari.
First, tell us about this alleged plan to buy $400 million worth of Teslas.
Right. So as you mentioned earlier this month, news reports came out highlighting this one item in a State Department spreadsheet of its expected contracts for the year. As you said, $400 million for armored Teslas, presumably the Cybertruck model, for transporting diplomats and other dignitaries around the world. The Trump administration says, you know, it's no longer standing by this plan. But in backing away from it, Trump officials pointed out that the talks with Tesla started in the Biden White House. That suggested that the $400 million idea may have started with them, but now I have a document that is casting serious doubt on that version of events.
Tell us about the document. What does it say?
Yeah, it's a document from a former Biden White House official showing exactly how much money the State Department planned to spend on electric vehicles this year, and it's $483,000, not $400 million. And this money was for light-duty EVs, not armored ones. When it comes to armored EVs, they were, you know, in very early stages with that. They were looking to tap Tesla to potentially do some market research on that and maybe prototype one out in the coming years. But how that already turned into a potential $400 million contract for armored Teslas really baffled my source, who was familiar with the talks between State and Tesla but was not authorized to speak publicly. This person said the $400 million Tesla item appeared not to be a clerical error but an intentional action.
Seems like $400 million could buy you a lot of electric vehicles, right?
Yeah, quite a bit. A lot of Cybertrucks in particular. And again, those are Elon Musk's Tesla's, you know, militaristic looking trucks, very angular in shape. You know, security experts told me $400 million might have been enough money to replace the State Department's entire fleet of armored vehicles around the world. Now, we don't know for sure that this was the goal, but experts told me that amount of money could buy thousands of Cybertrucks. Trump's State Department said the $400 million was an estimate. It never turned into an actual contract, and that, again, the agency is not moving forward with this plan. But just to be really clear here, Ari, the State Department officials under Biden who were discussing these plans were very skeptical of ever deploying armored EVs for a host of reasons. Armoring can add like 1,000 pounds to a vehicle. The Cybertruck already weighs 6,000 or 7,000 pounds. You know, armoring a battery can cause it to catch fire or to even explode, not to mention the lack of EV chargers in many parts of the world.
What kind of conflict of interest would it have created if the Trump administration were moving forward with this plan, given that Elon Musk owns Tesla?
Yeah, a quite stark one, right? Elon Musk is exerting an incredible amount of decision-making power in the White House right now over massive government workforce reductions, as we've been seeing, and other cost-cutting. And for weeks, ethics experts have been asking whether it's possible for Musk to continue this work without benefiting his business empire. And yes, if the White House did stick by this Tesla plan, it would likely become a big flashpoint. We still don't know who exactly put in the $400 million item into this budget and what their intention was, but we can say, though, is that this is not continuing any plans that began in the Biden administration, as far as we know.
NPR's Bobby Allen. Thank you.
Thank you, Ari.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com.
All right, and now to the Trump administration's government efficiency team, or DOGE, which wants to see massive layoffs at the federal housing agency known as HUD. The deepest cuts would be targeted at the office that funds homelessness programs at a time when the number of people without housing is at a record high. NPR's Jennifer Ludden is here to explain. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so what kind of staffing cuts is the Trump administration talking about here?
Well, for the Department of Housing and Urban Development, overall, the goal is to cut half the staff.
Wow.
And now that's according to an internal document NPR has obtained. It has a timeline for cuts by late May. So, you know, that would be sweeping and likely affect everything HUD does. But there are different targets for different offices. And according to the document, the office that distributes several billion dollars to prevent homelessness faces the most severe loss, 84% of its employees.
Wow.
So a real gutting there. And that office also funds affordable housing and disaster recovery.
Wow. Okay. So the idea of firing all of these people does raise the question of whether HUD could still do its job, right? Like, let's just start with homelessness programs. What could these cuts mean for that?
Well, you know, basically, advocates worry that record high homelessness would get even worse. I spoke with Ann Oliva. She's a former HUD official, and she now heads the National Alliance to End Homelessness. And she says HUD funds thousands of local nonprofits that work to keep people housed, and it takes manpower just to process all that money. She says the cuts would likely slow that down, and they'd hit people far beyond HUD headquarters in Washington, D.C.
We are talking about staff who directly support their communities in field offices all over the country. And they have a specific set of expertise that allows this money to flow to the people who need it the most.
And by the way, this homeless's money should be going out around this time, but the Trump administration has not confirmed or started sending it, which is making people nervous. Now, I asked HUD for comment, and a spokesperson says the agency is ensuring that it continues to deliver on its critical functions and its statutory responsibilities.
Okay, well, what about the other work that HUD does? Like, on housing itself, I imagine losing half of its employees would be a serious challenge, right?
Yes, absolutely. And HUD does a lot, right? It subsidizes rent for millions of people. It helps create affordable housing. It ensures mortgages for first-time and low-income buyers. And there is concern that all that could be disrupted and eventually lead more people to lose housing. Now, beyond the layoffs, we are also getting more information about the kinds of housing policies the Trump administration has in mind for HUD.
Fill us in.
So I've just heard from a HUD employee who was in an all-staff meeting on Thursday. They don't want to use their name because they fear losing their job for speaking publicly about the agency's new political leadership. This person said a high-ranking HUD appointee told the all-staff he wants the agency to serve only U.S. citizens. So that could mean evicting people without legal status, even if their spouse or children qualify for housing aid. This appointee also apparently talked about expanding work requirements for people in public housing and imposing time limits on housing aid. Now, all these things were either proposed in the first Trump administration or they're laid out in the conservative policy agenda that's called Project 2025.
That is NPR's Jennifer Ludden. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Iowa has the country's second highest cancer rate, and it's increasing. So 23-year-old Bree McNulty moved there to help fight the disease as a public health worker. But the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said it will terminate her next month. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
Bree McNulty grew up in Williamsburg, Virginia, fascinated with the bubonic plague and hoping to one day work at the CDC.
Everyone knows about the CDC. Like, you hear about them all the time. I think they've always been amazing, and I've loved learning about the work they do. Even in, like, movies like Contagion, like, I think those kind of also shaped my dreams of working for them.
She got her biology degree, then applied for the agency's prestigious Public Health Associate Program. Of over 1,000 applicants, McNulty was among 66 selected to work with public health programs across the country. In late 2023, she started a two-year term at the Iowa Cancer Consortium, which is stepping up to fight the state's high cancer rates. For McNulty, it was a dream.
Extremely excited, definitely cried a bit.
For the past year and a half, she's advocated for vaccines to prevent cervical cancer. She maintained databases tracking local disease trends, spoke at events, and created educational materials promoting early detection. A week ago last Saturday, the 23-year-old received an email, quote, removing her from her job. Other associates in her program were also among the 1,300 people cut from CDC and received the same email criticizing their performance using the same language.
The agency finds that you are not fit for continued employment because your ability, knowledge, and skills do not fit the agency's current needs, and your performance has not been adequate.
Kelly Wells-Sittig is executive director of the consortium where McNulty worked.
We were really happy with Bree's performance and growth.
Sittig says their efforts are already short-staffed. If the CDC program that sponsored McNulty disappears, she says, her community will lose opportunities to attract the healthcare talent the state so desperately needs.
We need young people coming to Iowa, working in our public health and healthcare workforce and our cancer control workforce. And losing Bree is a loss of that.
Bree McNulty says most people may not realize federal dollars fund work like hers in their neighborhoods.
People hear that there are cuts being made in CDC or NIH, their thought is, oh, they're only getting cut from DC or Atlanta. And that's just not true. Like, federal employees, field workers specifically, like, we are in your communities and doing the help that we can.
Now she's weighing her options, apply to grad school or try finding new work.
But job hunting is also intense now because you have these extremely highly educated, wonderful people who all just got let go at the same time and are all looking for a new job. And it's just going to be even more competitive than it was before.
McNulty says the abrupt, brusque end to her dream job leaves her feeling betrayed for just trying to help.
I grew up, you know, as a military brat and as someone who aspired to serve my country. I got my degree. I got good grades. I volunteered. Like, I do everything in my life to help people as much as I can because I care about others. Why am I being hurt for this when I did everything right?
She's furious, she says, but she's not quite sure where to direct the anger. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Soup, soda, and beer could be in store for price hikes soon. That's because the Trump administration's tariffs on steel and aluminum could make it more expensive to produce metal cans. The U.S. makes roughly 135 billion cans each year for foods, drinks, and lots of other items. And producers say the rising cost will hit consumers. NPR's Joe Hernandez reports.
Earlier this year, Ken Hendricks was hoping to get a better deal on aluminum cans. The owner of Alter Brewing Company in suburban Chicago was planning to ask his can supplier for a bulk discount. But after President Trump said he would impose 25% tariffs on steel and aluminum, Hendricks had to change his strategy.
I approached the meeting a little differently. And was hoping to hold my pricing for 2025, and I couldn't even get a commitment there.
Trump imposed similar tariffs during his first term, but there were major exemptions, and the tax on aluminum was much lower. Now, food and beverage industry leaders say the higher cost of importing those raw materials will mean higher costs for shoppers. Robert Budway is president of the Can Manufacturers Institute, an industry trade group.
Those costs of the metal are passed on to the food companies, and then those food companies pass on those costs to the consumer ultimately.
According to the trade group, 10% of the aluminum used to make aluminum cans in the U.S. is imported, but some 70% of the tin mill steel used to make steel food cans in the U.S. comes from outside the country. Now, business owners are scrambling to figure out whether the new tariffs will impact their bottom line. Kat Kavner-Wolf, co-founder and CEO of Heyday Canning Co., says she isn't sure if her small business will be paying more for their steel cans.
Because we are small, like, we don't have a direct relationship with these suppliers that are pretty big. Like, we don't have anyone that we can just pick up the phone and call and be like, where's your steel coming from?
If can prices do rise, businesses will have to adjust. Coca-Cola's CEO said the company could package more of its drinks in plastic bottles. Others may have to raise prices. But Hendricks, the brewery owner, says he's already squeezed by rising inflation and competition from larger companies.
We just don't have any more room to give without raising pricing. And if we raise price, I know that, you know, with people's buying power being less today, our volumes will decrease. So we're really at a tough spot.
The tariffs are set to take effect on March 12th. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
A legend of R&B has died. Singer and pianist Roberta Flack was 88 years old and died peacefully surrounded by her family, according to a statement from her publicist. Flack had ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. The Grammy-winning artist is best known for the songs The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face and Killing Me Softly with his song. NPR's Elizabeth Blair has this appreciation.
Roberta Flack sang with clarity and tenderness.
Strumming my pain with his fingers, singing my life with his words, killing me softly with his song, killing me softly with his song, telling my whole life with his words, killing me softly.
Her influence on musicians is enormous. Adele said she learned control from listening to Flack's voice. Alicia Keys said watching Flack make a career as both a singer and a pianist gave her life and direction. Roberta Flack was 15 when she received a full music scholarship to Howard University. Her dream was to become a concert pianist, but Flack's teachers knew racism would make that difficult in the white world of classical music. Here's Flack talking to NPR in 2012.
My real ambition was to be a concert pianist and to play Schumann and Bach and, you know, Chopin, the Romantics. Those were my guys. And I was really sad that I had not reached my goal, which was to play at Carnegie Hall. I got there, but I got there by playing songs like Here, There, and Everywhere.
Here, making each day of the year, changing my life with a wave of his hand.
Roberta Flack,
Now that is a person with a voice. Nobody.
Pianist and vocalist Les McCann told NPR he first heard Roberta Flack in 1968 at a club in Washington, D.C.
It just blew my mind, and I called up the record company to tell them about it, and they said they didn't want to hear it. So I got my tape recorder, all my mics, and set it up and recorded it myself. And then we took the tape in, and they said, oh, is this who you were talking about? We changed our minds, you know.
And that's how Roberta Flack got a record deal.
Looks like we always end up in a rut, trying to make it real. But compared to what?
First Take was released in 1969, but the album didn't really become a hit until a few years later, when Clint Eastwood used this song in the movie Play Misty For Me.
The first time ever I saw your face.
The first time ever I saw your face was written by folk musician Ewan McCall. It's been covered by a lot of singers, but NPR music critic Ann Powers says Roberta Flack made the song an exquisite suspension of time.
It reduces your blood pressure. It changes your equilibrium. It has an effect on the body.
I felt the earth.
Roberta Flack was a superstar in the 1970s. She became the first artist to win the Grammy for Record of the Year 2 years in a row. But Ann Powers says Flack didn't always get the critical respect she deserved because she was performing at a time when songwriters were getting most of the attention.
The idea that you had to write your own material was held up as the gold standard. But for much longer, interpreters were the greats. And Roberta Flack stands with Sinatra, with Ella Fitzgerald, with so many great interpreters of the 20th century as someone who made every song she approached original.
Roberta Flack went on to win 5 Grammys, including a Lifetime Achievement Award. She used her fame to elevate humanitarian causes and celebrate Black excellence. She championed Black artists, including Luther Vandross and Peabo Bryson. She was one of the first investors in Black radio.
Dedication is the key word.
Roberta Flack, talking to NPR in 1989.
Dedication and devotion, because you may study voice for years and never get a chance to find, as my voice teacher said to me years ago, that light. He used to say to me, Roberta, find your light. Where's your light? Pretend you're underneath it. Find the light.
Roberta Flack found the light and shared it. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
This is NPR News. Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive. Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the vehicles that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks, at ProgressiveCommercial.com. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice, at AJWS.org. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
We want to get Wenton's daddy up here, Ellis Marcellus, to play with Wenton. Let's see if we can get him up here to do that. Yeah? Come on, let's have it.